You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are.
Full moon tonight.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. Moonrise over the mountain.
Yes, it was gorgeous.
Very gorgeous. We live in a very beautiful big sky spot. It's lovely. And what happened this week? Was it this week? Well, it was that.
No. It was almost 2 weeks
ago. We haven't podcasted since it happened.
Yeah.
It was about 8.
We podcasted the night before it happened, I think.
Yeah, we did. It was like, anyhow, the election happened. Donald Trump is the president-elect. Joe Biden is the, I think the phrase is lame duck. No, it is. Lame duck. Yeah, he's a lame duck president. That's what, literally, that's the phrase.
Oh my God, that's a terrible phrase.
I don't know. It seems kind of appropriate in this case. Yeah, so... Big election. I don't know. Republican sweep, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, totally.
Completely.
Senate, House of Representatives, and President. It's been weird. A lot of people we know are very unhappy.
Yes.
Family, friends, colleagues.
Well, wait, I think everybody we know.
Yeah. I don't think we were saying the other day, I don't think we know a single person who voted for Trump, at least didn't say they did.
Yeah.
But we're both in the art world.
I mean, that's like kind of embarrassing in a way, isn't it?
Well,
like, shouldn't we know at least somebody who's celebrating?
Yeah, but again, I think... There's a lot of people you don't know who they voted for.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the only people you really know who they voted for are the people who talk about it online. So
yeah.
And I was thinking the other day, my impression was that all my like Facebook friends were lamenting the election, but I have like 4,000 Facebook friends, and I could probably actually count on my two hands the number of people who have actually expressed. I mean, there's been other people and stuff, but it's not like everybody. You know what I mean?
I think that's why they say, like, silence is... What's the phrase?
Silence is violence.
Silence is violence.
Yeah. No, I guess I just mean, like, we hear people talking about the election or being political, and we think, oh, everyone's being political, but often it's actually just a fraction of people.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it's been weird, I guess, since that happened, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the vibe is very much now like these like pirate tech bros moving to Washington, D.C. to like turn the country inside out, surrounded by massive choruses of grief and and resistance. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, totally.
It's really, it's really dramatic. Yeah, it's very
incredibly
dramatic.
Incredibly dramatic. Very cinematic as well.
Yeah, but at the same time, I will say, like, when Trump was elected in 2016, the cries of resistance and we're going to stop this went on for months. I mean, actually, it went on for 4 years. This time, there was like 2 to 3 days of moaning and lamenting, but I think it's largely stopped.
Yeah.
And even the newspapers, the big liberal newspapers, seem to just kind of have their head in the sand. And I think that's just because the Democrats got so badly beaten.
Yeah.
I think they don't quite know what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry, I had to silence the baby. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, like, you know, most people do know people who vote for Trump. You know, I think that if you work at a university or you're in the arts, like we are, they might be few and far between. I think most people do know people.
Yeah.
You know, you work at a job. There's going to be both kinds of people there.
Yeah.
Not in the arts and not at universities, but you know.
Yeah, and we're
We also live a million miles away from everyone. So yeah. Who do we really know?
Yeah, that's true.
We don't talk to anybody. Yeah. You have been shocked at how isolated you feel in terms of, like when Trump wins, you're like, where are these people?
Yeah. Who are these people?
I've never met a single one.
Yeah, it's true.
That's what kind of shocks you, I think, about the whole thing, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think we don't like getting political, even though sometimes we talk about politics, right? So, but we do talk about liberalism quite a lot. I like something you said the other day. You said, Trump is Buddha, Harris is Buddha, something like that. I thought that was pretty interesting. Just as a way to be like against both of them or in reaction or relation to both of them, like the feelings one has is a way to examine and learn oneself.
Mm.
So I think a lot of, I think at least with the people who I see talking of my friends, the tendency is to get really, really swept up. That was the other thing that I was thinking. Another thing that really struck me was seeing, I'm not sure how much we've discussed this, but like how much anxiety I see reflected in politics.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely say that the reaction to the election from everyone I know, again, and I only know Democrats, was one of fear and anxiety and needing to real like emotional solace and you know, a lot of messages of like, we need to take care of each other and you need to check in with your friends. It was almost like there was a hurricane or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, or there was when people are like, what is there, that thing on Facebook you can
yes,
say
yeah.
checking in is safe.
Yeah, totally.
Right? I feel like people were
God, they should have done that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, people need to be able to check in as safe
from the
results of the election.
Yeah, exactly.
Because people were acting as if we all really needed to reach out to each other. So
Yeah.
I mean, anxiety is a big common theme among Democrats, I would say. I don't see it as much among Republicans, again, not Republican friends because I don't have any, but just in the way they seem to handle elections and events
yeah.
that don't go their way, it seems to be a little more, a different kind of response. Anger. I mean, it's definitely anger from Democrats too, but
yeah,
I think Democrats are a little more touchy-feely.
Yeah.
Is that the phrase, touchy-feely?
Yeah.
Warm and cuddly?
So.
Warm and, a little more emotional support animals.
Yes.
Democrats are emotional support animals to each other,
yes.
I think, more than Republicans. Anyhow, so new president, new era, not new president yet, but soon to be new president. But we're moving on. We only have one president in this house, and that's Martin Heidegger. that's not true. For the record, I honor the president of the United States, no matter who he or she is. We're on Heidegger. Do you know where we are?
I think we're section 31.
Let's look here.
Is that right?
I think that is correct.
Which is page 55.
Yes, the style of inceptual thinking.
Yes.
Great. So we're reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event. Again, when you hear the word bang, that is B-E-Y-N-G. It's an alternative spelling of being. It's a different kind of being. And the whole book is about trying to figure out what kind of being bang is. So that's what we're doing. I'm excited. It's been a while. Go ahead.
Yeah. 31, the style of inceptual thinking. Style, the self-certainty of Dasein in its grounding, law-giving, and in its enduring of wrath. The style of restraint, because restraint disposes steadfastness pervasively and from the ground up as the remembering expectation of the event. this restraint also pervasively disposes all playing out of the strife between the world and earth. Restraint is subservient to the gentle measure, enduring it through silence, and undergoes the bitter wrath. These both, belonging to each other, encounter each other in different ways out of the earth as well as from the world. Go ahead.
You want to just read the last little paragraph?
Sure. Is that the last paragraph? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Style as a grown certainty is the law of the carrying out of truth in the sense of the sheltering in beings. Because art, for example, is the setting of truth into a work, and because in the work, the sheltering in itself comes to stand in relation to itself, therefore, quote, style, even if barely grasped, is visible, especially in the field of art. Nevertheless, the idea of style is here not broadened and transferred from art to Dasein as such.
So apparently in conceptual thinking, which is originary thinking, decisive thinking, thinking as a way of escaping the metaphysical history that we have been handed, has a style. So style, this means, you know, the way that we talk about a poet's style or an artist's style, right? The style of Picasso, the style of Shakespeare, style of an artist is a very mysterious thing, very almost difficult thing to assess and enumerate. You know, the style of Picasso, you can describe multiple works of his, but how do you describe his style? So it's a mysterious word. It's a hard word to give a lot of tangible meaning to, but it's an important word. And he says, style, the self-certainty of Dasein in its grounding, law-giving, and in its enduring of wrath.
That's a beautiful sentence.
Yeah. So, in a sense, like art has, like every, like an artist has a style. Dasein, every Dasein has a style. Dasein, again, is every person, a person who is endowed with Dasein. Their Dasein has a style, and that style, the style of Dasein is the self-certainty of Dasein. So there's a way in which Dasein presents its self-certainty, and that is its style. For instance, you could take Dasein out of there and say Picasso. So what is the style of Picasso? The self-certainty of Picasso in his grounding, law-giving, and in his enduring of wrath. So wrath is going to be that word that is used in this, in the phrase, the wrath of God. So it's an old word, and it basically means the, how shall we say, the destructive forces of existence. So he's defining style here. Style is a person's self-certainty in how that they, in how they ground a law giving and how they endure against wrath, in what way they endure against wrath. And so again, law giving is just, Picasso was a lawgiver. He laid down aesthetic laws. He grounded aesthetic laws. And he endured the destructive forces of the world, and in turn created, as all artists do. But then he goes on, the style of restraint, because restraint disposes steadfastness pervasively and from the ground up as the remembering expectation of the event. So I think he's emphasizing here that inherent to the idea of style is a certain restraint. Picasso didn't paint everything. Picasso faced a billion choices and only took the most aesthetic, wisest, most Picasso-esque ones. So he practiced restraint style of restraint. Restraint is an important element of style because restraint disposes steadfastness pervasively. So it basically outlays or manifests steadfastness or committed drive pervasively. So it basically distributes your ambition throughout everything you do. So you don't just do randomly or vastly or sporadically. You do in a steadfast, pervasive manner through the disposition that is endowed to you by your restraint. And from the ground up, restraint disposes from the ground up, meaning from the very base of your being, as a remembering expectation of the event. So an event you remember and you expect it again. So it's a description of the creative process. Mm. This restraint also pervasively disposes all playing out of the strife between world and earth. Picasso played out the strife between world and earth, or between culture and nature, right? Or between identity and instinct, world and earth. Restraint is subservient to the gentle measure. The gentle measure. I don't know what he means by that. But I would say the gentle measure is probably the very present and almost passive and almost silent, mysterious, and omniscient standards of aesthetics that govern everything. We don't even know them, but they make aesthetic a word we can even understand. Restraint is subservient to this silent aesthetic law, enduring it through silence, accepting its silence, and restraint undergoes the bitter wrath. These both belonging to each other, so probably the gentle measure and the bitter wrath, these both belonging to each other, encounter each other in different ways out of the earth as well as from the world. So they encounter each other through instinct and identity. He continues in this poetic manner, style as a grown certainty. So that makes sense, right? An artist's style is a grown certainty, mm-hmm. a developed confidence. Style is the law of the carrying out of truth in the sense of the sheltering in beings. So you carry out the truth through the sheltering in beings. Sheltering, he uses this word a lot, and I think it means to reserve, preserve, sustain, bring in, and shelter. That's what we do when we create things, right? Mm-hmm. I bring a bunch of words in, I amass them, I put them on the page, and I shelter them in beings, mm-hmm. in paper. Mm-hmm. You shelter beings in oils and in inks and in computer pixels, right? Everything, your art is a
sheltering of beings.
Yeah, it's a confabulation of beings. That's what it is. It's only a giant mishmash of beings. Because art, for example, is the setting of truth into a work, and because in the work the sheltering in itself comes to stand in relation to itself, so the sheltering of beings in the work stands in a relation to itself. That's in a sense what we think about when we look at a work of art, is how has it sheltered beings, what beings has it sheltered, and what is its relationship to the beings it has sheltered? Is it sheltering them to slaughter them? Is it sheltering them to save them from something? If so, what is it saving them from? Is it sheltering them out of respect or out of disdain? Is your artwork a concentration camp or a five-star hotel for the beings in it? Therefore, style, even if barely grasped, is visible, especially in the field of art. Nevertheless, the idea of style is here not broadened and transferred from art to Dasein as such. That last sentence is really like, look, I understand there's style in art, and how we think of style is usually through an artist, but I don't mean that we can just take that sense of style and apply it to Dasein, because Dasein is different than art. Mm. It's just a kind of a, you know, him like keeping house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice little section. Again, a very like Heidegger using the way he thinks about things to talk about something very common, mm-hmm. To give a new set of parameters to the descriptive possibilities of that thing. So artistic style, the nature of a work, why artworks contain what they can't contain, how art relates to truth, how the artist practices, what it means for the artist to have a style, how style manifests itself in the world versus in the earth, on the earth. All very interesting, deep ontological questions about the emergence and practice of art, yes, and also of just Dasein.
Why is he saying that it isn't transferable from art to Dasein? Because it feels so transferable.
Well, Dasein.
Or then,
okay.
What is it?
I would say because Dasein is not art, and yeah. Art is not Dasein.
Right.
Dasein produces art, but you.
But
can't
you
just
took Dasein and you put the word Picasso in there, and it all made sense.
Picasso is not art. Picasso is a Dasein.
Yeah.
Picasso's art is art.
I see.
So, you know, if I had said the self-certainty of Picasso's art in its grounding law-giving and in its enduring of wrath, that would be a little weird. Mm-hmm. Like you would know that I was actually talking about Picasso. Because mm-hmm. art cannot be self-certain.
Yeah.
Art does not give laws. Art does not endure wrath. I mean, in any real way, not in mm-hmm. not in a Dasein way, not in an intentional, active, and I think that it's an important distinction because, you know, one thing Heidegger really, I think, tries to make clear is that Dasein is very special in this universe. Mm-hmm. I don't think he thinks animals have Dasein. I don't think he thinks art has Dasein. Mm-hmm. He definitely doesn't think concepts have Dasein. There's a little bit of, I don't know how to put it, like divinical thinking in Heidegger. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever read him fully explicate the difference between humans and animals and what that means for Dasein, but I do think he believes humans are a little special, largely through the way they engage with logos. Mm-hmm. Language, meaning, logic, etc., which is integral to Dasein. Anyhow.
Something else that's interesting is the self-certainty idea. Like, we've talked about certainty here and there, and I feel like this might be one of the first places where he's like, this is where certainty is.
Yeah, tell me more. What do you mean? Certain. We've talked about certainty, and this is where certainty is. What do you mean?
We've
talked
past,
about certainty while talking about this book.
Yeah, like uh-huh. the word has come up a few times, mm-hmm. and I kind of hone into it because it's like a, like we've talked about that. Like, actually, maybe it was last time we were talking about how, in the anxiety literature, the idea is to be okay with uncertainty because life is uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
And as I can't remember all that we went into there, but I think part of it was like, oh, well, that is definitely convenient for their profession to say that life is uncertain. But I also can't quite remember
what Heidegger has really said about the word directly, but I feel like this is sort of one of the first times where he's been like, well, here is certainty. And he uses the word twice in style of certainty.
I would agree. I mean, and he... Yeah, did he say style is certainty there? Style is a grown certainty, yeah. I mean, the first time he uses it, he uses the phrase self-certainty.
Self-certainty, yeah.
Which I would say, you know, in my distinction between self and identity, self-certainty means you are certain of yourself as an independent, authentic, agential thing, as a Dasein.
Mm-hmm.
So self-certainty... is kind of self-certainty, I would say, is different than being certain of facts or conditions or world dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Self-certainty is you have a grounded, almost tangible sense of yourself as irrefutable and undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, you're right. He says, style is a grown certainty. And again, I paraphrase that as a developed confidence.
Mm-hmm.
But certainty is good. You're right. And when he's talking about truth, certainty is the critical word. I mean, of truth, one must be certain.
Mm-hmm.
So because he's talking about the carrying out of truth, certainty is a good word.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you know, he's not here saying that we're going to be certain of logical propositions. He's right. here saying that we're going to be certain in the assertion of both our artistic will and our artistic ambition and of ourself as it manifests itself in Dasein. So there's kind of, I would say, almost like it's not a cognitive or logical certainty.
It's
almost an emphatic certainty, I would say. Like when you manifest yourself in your artwork, you are making certain yourself by placing truth in the artwork via the sheltering of beings.
Mm.
So it's in a way a certainty in action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should we keep reading?
I think so.
Yeah. 32, the event. A decisive gaze after the carrying out of the resonating and the interplay. The task now is to gaze in advance at the relation of being and truth, and to see how out of this relation, time and space are grounded in their original belonging together, despite their strangeness.
Yeah, so now we're going to look ahead at the relation of being and truth. We've been using these words, being and truth, and we're going to look at their relationship. And in this relationship, we're going to see that time and space are grounded in their original belonging together, despite their strangeness, both their strangeness to us and, in a sense, their strangeness to each other. And this is in a way a reiteration of what he's been saying a lot, but he hasn't been saying it as directly. And that is that in a Heideggerian assessment of being and in a Heideggerian assessment of truth and a Heideggerian assessment of their relationship, time and space are not just accidental settings for the occurrence of these concepts. Time and space are actually grounding and requisite conditions and aspects of these things. And in their belonging together, they relate to being and truth in a very integral, critical way. In other words, we're not going to be talking about being and we're not going to be talking about truth separate from time and space, because that Heidegger would say, is mad folly. Yeah. Go ahead.
Truth is the clearing, concealing, which occurs as transporting and captivation. These, in their unity as well as in excess, provide the encompassed open realm for the play of beings which, in the sheltering of their truth, come to be as thing, tool, machination, work, act, sacrifice.
Yeah, we've heard this before. Truth is the clearing, concealing. So truth for Heidegger is something emerges and then it goes back away. That's all truth is for him. It's not a proposition. It's not a logical structure. It's not a metaphysical necessity. It's not a rule of thought. It's literally a stepping out and making and becoming visible, mm-hmm. and then a going away, as all things must. So truth is the clearing, concealing, which occurs as transporting and captivation, as movement and captivation, becoming captivated. These, in their unity as well as in excess, this transporting and captivation, the way we become captivated by movement, provide the encompassed open realm for the play of beings. So this open, enclosed realm in which things happen, the play of beings occurs. So these, in their unity as well as in excess, provide the encompassed open realm for the play of beings, which, in the sheltering of their truth, so in the way that the transporting and the captivation are eventually sheltered or taken in via the truth of them, they come to be in this beautiful open realm a thing or a tool or a machination or a work or an act or a sacrifice. So these beings emerge, basically. Go ahead.
But with truth, there's still an idea of there being like truth, right? Like an essential truth, or like we're trying to figure out the truth of being here or something. Because it's a clearing, concealing, but of truth. Or because you can clear and conceal a lot of things.
Yeah, what are you asking? It's a good question. Tell me more. It's very, very thick. It's very hard. The truth is clear and concealing is a very hard idea.
Yeah.
It definitely thrusts the mind out of what is habitual and understood into what feels like a very suspicious modality of confusion.
Yeah.
You're right, because, okay, so let's think through that. Can a non-truth be cleared and then concealed?
I mean, I think so.
Well, but how? I mean, if something emerges and then passes away, let's say it emerges and it, okay, so let's say the moon is made of cheese is the headline on the New York Times tomorrow, right?
Uh-huh.
The moon is made of cheese, and that's the headline of the paper tomorrow. And then the next day the headline is Biden challenges Trump to a game of pickleball. So the moon is made of cheese was the headline for one day. It emerged, it was cleared, we see it, and then it's concealed and it goes away, right? Mm-hmm. It is a non-truth, but is it not true that it appeared?
Mm-hmm.
And is it not true in appearing? And is it not a truth in the sense that it's a statement? Maybe there are even people who believe it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Heidegger is trying to take the idea of truth out of the realm of verifiable fact, mm-hmm. because I think he would probably say no fact is verifiable. Mm-hmm. There can be regularities of demonstration. There can be consistencies of evidence. There can be our eyes don't lie. There can be agreed upon normalities in all our thinking and all the way that the universe behaves. Apples fall when you drop them. The sun rises. Mountains are higher than oceans, etc. But those truths, let's take the truth. Mountains are higher than oceans, right? So we think of mountains are higher than oceans as a really a logical proposition. It says mountains are higher than oceans, and that mountains are not higher than oceans is not true. So mountains are higher than oceans is true. Mountains are not higher than oceans is not true. So we have this little binary, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how we think about truth. Well, Heidegger would say mountains are higher than oceans is true in its appearance as a truth. That's what makes it a truth. Mountains are not higher than oceans is also a truth because it appears. And mountains are not higher than oceans appears before us as a statement. Now, in the world of logical propositions, we can say it's false. It is not true in the world of logical propositions. But Heidegger would say the world of logical propositions is a very distinct world. It is not a world that has been handed any key to the city, shall we say. It need not, and it does not, contain any precedence over experience. In the old thinking, it does, but in Heidegger's world, it does not. So truth, he's trying to pull truth out of logical proposition. Now, we, of course, continue to think about truth in that way, mm-hmm. right? Because we are trained to think about truth in that way. But as a phenomenologist, Heidegger is saying truth is simply the emergence of a being which then also ultimately eventually passes away because all things come and go. Hmm. So that was a long mm-hmm. route to take, but tell me how that makes you feel. Or like,
I'm always thinking about anxiety in this great. Context. Yeah, yeah, so please. Like for me, I'm not, because anxious thoughts come and go constantly and they reveal and conceal themselves constantly, but I don't like to think of them as truth. Like we've talked about them sort of as a being's abandoned by being because they have sort of an emptiness to them. But technically, kind of, based on how you're saying, I feel like they actually could be truths.
Well, we have to ask ourselves, well, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, although maybe there's more to it.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a word, this is a heavy word, truth. And it's going to have different insinuations, different significations, depending on context. So when you say an anxious thought is not true, right? Mm-hmm. Was that something you would say?
Yeah.
That an anxious thought is a proper object of a truth question?
Yeah.
So give me, for instance, an anxious thought that you would feel it was appropriate to say is not true.
I literally can't
Well, give okay, so I'm well,
like
okay.
literally well, can't okay, think of a single
let's take
one.
It, let's take it out of your life, and let's say we have somebody who's anxious, okay, uh-huh. right? And they're anxious that Trump is going to set up a system of concentration camps, mm-hmm. build a train line, and start putting liberals on the trains and sending them to the ovens. Mm-hmm. So they're anxious. So their anxious thought is Trump is going to kill us all.
Yeah.
And then, so the standard response to that would be, if it's going to be a, you know, question as a truth claim, no, he's not, or yes, he is. So uh-huh. is that true? But of course, that's not, I think in my view, that's not exactly a good way to use the word true. Uh-huh. Right? Because there's no way to assess if it's true or not. It's not actually a truth. What that person is actually doing is they're imagining a future, right? Mm-hmm. And they're investing it with belief. Mm-hmm. But there's no way to determine if that belief is true or not, because it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And the statement, it will happen, that statement, I don't know if that's proper to really say that statement is true or false. Mm-hmm. That statement is actually just the expression of a belief. Mm-hmm. So I think we use the word true vis-a-vis anxious thoughts a little too incorrectly.
How so?
Well, like I said, I think you have to ask yourself, in what realm of cognitive activity can we really use the word true mm-hmm. in a way in which we are allowed to mm-hmm. actually partake in verifiable assessments of a truth statement. Mm-hmm. So again,
yeah.
I think it's standard to use the words Trump's going to kill us all is not true. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we're using the word true correctly there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's like a projected future imagining.
Yeah.
And you can't really have true or false there.
You can't. No, you can't. Because, I mean, if you can go farther and see why. Because you could say, that's not true. And the other person will say, yes, it is. And the only way, if you're a judge and standing between the two, is to say, well, let's look at the situation and see what is true. Mm-hmm. And you start looking and you say, finally, oh, there's no situation. Because mm-hmm. the situation is to come. Mm-hmm. So there's no thing to assess. Mm-hmm. It's just this person has this projected belief about the future. Mm-hmm. Another person has a opposite projected belief. Mm-hmm. There's no way to decide if either is true or false yet, because they're both about a situation that has not yet occurred. Mm-hmm. So we use the word true in these situations. So again, I think that we use the word true on anxious thoughts, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure that's a really good use of the word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
For instance, unlikely might be a word to use, or likely, but then again, now you're just basically dealing with probabilities and gambling, mm-hmm. right? A person could go on ad nauseum about all the signs that Trump is going to kill us all, mm-hmm. and another person could go on with all the signs and the historical precedents and whatever that says that he's not, but you're not talking about truth. You're actually just talking about probabilities. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fallaciously so, really. Like, neither of you are actually really talking about very much at all. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's keep asking ourselves, where is truth? What can we think of as truth? Mm-hmm. And I think to round that up, I think that's a nice, important thing to think about, because as you think about anxiety, as you think about anxious thoughts, and you start to juxtapose your true thoughts with your untrue thoughts. Mm-hmm. And you start to say, these anxious thoughts, those are untrue. Mm-hmm. And these other thoughts that I have are true. Mm. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I worry that that is actually just anxiety as well.
Mm-hmm.
I worry that thinking that anxious thoughts are true or not true and worrying about their trueness is actually just anxiety.
Yeah.
Because you're actually not really using the concept of truth in a thorough, exact way.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually using it as a tool against yourself
mm-hmm.
or as a tool against anxiety, but it's a bad tool. It doesn't actually mm-hmm. fit.
Mm-hmm.
You're using a hammer to screw in a screw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think asking about the truth of anxiety thoughts is a trap.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's also, I'll say, very common in the anxiety literature, which is just that the content of the thoughts is not really supposedly of importance.
Mm-hmm.
It's really how you, it's the feeling of it that is in common.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that was something, it's funny, I was trying to say at the beginning, but couldn't figure out how to, that I see a lot of anxiety in politics. And you brought up the thing about Trump taking people to the whatever, putting them on a car,
putting them on merry-go-rounds.
Merry-go-rounds. And that's totally, like, I think I see a lot, like, I don't have that kind of anxiety, but I guess that's what they call the Trump derangement syndrome or something, right? It's like that, like, really intense anxiety around Trump. And one could say, or like the anxiety literature in a way would say, is that actually it's just anxiety put on something else. So my anxiety goes somewhere else. Another person's anxiety goes there. It just kind of moves around.
Yes.
So I don't know.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, if you're going to place on an even plane your or somebody's anxiety about jumping off a cliff or picking up a knife and killing yourself or everybody you know,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to equate that to worrying about Trump and his minions mm-hmm. destroying America, that's a heavy claim.
Why?
Because the people who think that Trump and his minions are going to destroy America,
right?
If they were here right now, they have a lot of reasons for thinking that.
Yeah.
So do you have a lot of reasons for thinking you're going to hurt yourself? Or would you say that they're, I mean, are they the same kind of anxiety? Those two things, I wonder.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Maybe let's get back. let's get back to the idea of truth. I mean, so I think if we were to shed away. So I'm going to say that I think there's probably something in identity about identity in here. You know that what you're really doing when you're saying Trump is going to kill us all is you're investing in an identity pattern because you're seeing yourself projected into the future as a person being killed by Trump. You're not accepting that there might be a gap or a break or an indiscernible vacuum across which you have no idea if existence is going to ever make it or not.
Just time and space.
Yeah, I mean, you're certain of this. You're certain that you're going to be there then. Mm-hmm. There then. That's space and time. You're going to be there in space, then in time, when the killing happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the person who doesn't believe that is saying, I'm not going to be there then, nor are you going to be there then. Mm-hmm. But that too is an identity statement.
Mm-hmm.
So both people are really talking about nothing. Like whenever you talk about identity, you're always just talking about nothing. So then we have to go back and say, well, I guess as a question, I think you wonder where we're supposed to find truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And why? Is it because you're a scientist or you're anxious or you're a logician or...
I mean, I think because I think that truth is what I need to find in order to feel, I guess, safe and
yes,
free.
Exactly. So that exactly. Good answer. That's right. And and you know what I said just a little bit ago, I think,
yeah,
is that believing that your safety lies somewhere in the proper placement of your thoughts, feelings, and assertions in the proper side of the truth, non-truth binary, I think is a pretty tall order.
Yeah.
And I think you're not doing yourself fair there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, you say it very well. You want truth so you can feel safe. Because only in truth, only in the sheltering of truth, in that shelter called truth, you will find safety.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, yeah, not.
Yeah.
If you're going to find your safety in truth, and this is identitarianism, because truth, again, is roses are red. That's an identity statement. And that's a truth. And so you shelter in that truth.
Mm-hmm.
You seek haven in that identity. But there's always things creeping around.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always things messing with your head. There's always things countering that identity. And so I don't think, and you know, in the age of facts, speaking of politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Facts are seen as a shelter against the scariness,
mm-hmm, yeah,
of the pirating tech bros.
Yeah.
The problem with all this is if truth and facts become your shelter, then things that do not,
yeah,
adhere to those truth and facts become your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start a war. And there's lots of war.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to pedal back from this idea of truth. Meaning we need to pedal back from this idea that most of the things we think of as being correctly apportioned according to truth cannot actually be so.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are, yeah, addicted to that apportioning. We're addicted to that sheltering. We're addicted to that sense of safety. And we get really bound up and wound up and stressed about preserving that truth.
Mm-hmm.
Heidegger would say there's another concept of truth, and that is that things happen and then they go away. And everything that happens, everything that emerges out of nothing and then is and then goes away, is truth.
Hmm.
And this is important because I think that our instinct to shelter in truth is probably right,
mm-hmm,
but I think we're sheltering in non-truths.
Mm-hmm.
That's what machination is. That's what being abandoned by being, mm-hmm, is. That's what identity is.
Mm-hmm.
They're non-truths. The truth is bang. And bang is the event. And the event emerges and then recedes. It's the coming and going of the God. It's bang.
Mm-hmm.
And if that can be your truth, and that can be your shelter, that's like saying, in sum, I find comfort in reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to find comfort in reality is very hard, but very awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So truth maintains its shelter status.
Yeah.
It's just we've moved the shelter from off a precarious spinning wheel of chaos and lies to the ground.
Yeah.
Where you can actually rest.
Yeah.
And you're not caught up in this forkakta game of truth versus non-truth.
Mm-hmm.
Where really what you're actually talking about is one belief versus another, mm-hmm. or one person's projection versus another person's projection,
mm-hmm.
or one person's fear versus one person's revenge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
None of which have anything to do with truth.
Yeah. So find comfort in reality. That's a very beautiful idea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, we're all going to die and rot and be sliced into a million pieces, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to live with that.
Mm-hmm.
That is your bed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And which is in a sense to say, why are we seeking comfort? What are we seeking comfort against? Comfort in reality, even in itself, is like, I mean, it's an oxymoron in a way.
Mm-hmm.
To seek comfort in reality is in a way to give up on the hope for comfort or the need for comfort. Because the need for comfort only emerges because you find your fate unbearable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But your fate is not unbearable because, you know what? You're going to bear it.
Mm-hmm.
Like it or not. Dark turn.
Yeah. It is.
But I don't know. What else do you think?
I don't know.
I mean, it's always been interesting to me that a thought can be tormenting.
Mm-hmm.
I am definitely not tormented by my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't relate. I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a reservoir of experience of that nature. So I continue to be fascinated by when you tell me about why and how thoughts are tormenting. Like what? Because in a way I feel like, oh, well, then you must not be talking about thoughts, because I have lots of thoughts. I know my thoughts. I know thoughts. I'm thoughts. They're all around. Of course, they're not tormenting. I like them. They're perfectly decent people. So I wonder if we're talking about the same thing. No, seriously.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way my thoughts cannot be tormenting and your thoughts can be tormenting, yet they're the same thing. Although, at the same time, I walk by knives in the kitchen all the time. Don't think about it, but sometimes they freak you out.
Yeah.
Same knife, same knives. So, you know, I don't know. So what is that about thoughts are tormenting? Because again, I can think Trump's going to kill us all, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can think Trump's going to kill us all, but I can't find the fear and torment of that thought. I can't find
mm-hmm.
it. Somebody else definitely can.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between us? Must be in what we believe. It must be the evidence we have. It must be how we think the arc of history is bending.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that Heidegger talks about thinking in the first beginning as an assertion, as a claim to truth. So I think that just the putting of words to something has a bit of a, a bit of a claim to it being true in the old way of truth. And that's what makes it scary, because if it's saying that this is true, that like this is dangerous or that's dangerous, then in thinking it, it's you're manifesting that it's true in a way.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So for instance, if the sentence, I'm going to grab that knife and hurt myself, like your mind says that out loud, like you don't choose to say it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That statement pops into your head.
Yeah.
And because it's been put into words, you think it must be true.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm not sure. I think it must be true, but I just think it carries some weight of that nature.
Yes. Well, then we circle back then, don't we, to Trump's going to kill us all.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we all, I'm included, everyone, we all continue to think that a statement like, I'm going to do this, or this is going to have any statement about a possible set of events is properly considered through the filter of truth or non-truth.
Mm-hmm.
We are so trained and conditioned in doing that. And 95% of our conversation is that. All political conversation is that, right? We're all sitting around talking about what the truth of what is going to happen or the non-truth of what is going to happen. And of course, it's all nonsense. Utter nonsense. Because we cannot assess the truth of anything in the future. So I think what we've discovered is that it's not that this thought, I'm going to hurt myself with a knife, has been put into words that makes it scary. It's that when things are put into words, you immediately ask the truth or non-truth of them. And when a thing is a projected possibility, you cannot assess it according to truth or non-truth, yet you try. And that makes you anxious.
Yeah.
You're trying to figure out if something is true or non-true that you cannot figure out if it is true or non-true. And that sounds very anxiety-inducing. Especially, and probably singularly, with things that, if they're true, are really scary. But they can't be true or untrue. They're not those kind of statements. They're not that kind of thing. And truth's not what, truth versus non-truth is not the binary you think it is. So it's in your habits of truth assessment that anxiety is born. And those habits of truth assessment were hardwired into you by the first beginning. Everything you've read, everything you've been taught, everything your parents told you, all the conversations you've heard and had in college and for many years after, before you woke up to Heidegger, right? Conditioned you for this way of thinking. Does that make sense?
Am I
talking sense?
No, it totally makes sense. Yes, it does make sense.
I do feel like the natural reaction is to say, yes, but if I were to abandon this, well, two reactions. A, how do I know what can be properly thought through the binary of truth and non-truth? What can be thought that way? What should be thought that way? And B, if I really abandon this truth, non-truth binary as applied to lots of the things that go on in my head and in the world, what am I left with?
Yeah.
And isn't that scary? Isn't that a scary place? Isn't my truth? I mean, a lot of people think that their truth seeking is what gives them hope and keeps them alive and keeps them safe. Mm. Whereas I would say actually it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So much of liberalism, and I mean that in the broadest term, so much of, how should we say, the enlightened mind,
mm-hmm,
is a set or a series of active belief practices that assert certain things because those things aren't true. But when those things aren't true, that's really scary. Mm. So the assertion becomes very dogmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And very principled and very communitarian,
mm-hmm,
and very enforced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are what we would call the oxymorons or the paradoxes of liberalism.
Yeah.
The smokescreens of liberalism.
Yeah.
In the broader sense.
Yeah.
The dogmatic beliefs that so forcefully, so forcefully are put forward every day.
Yeah.
Because unconsciously, everyone knows they're not true.
Yeah.
But them not being true is almost too much to bear.
Right. Right. Yeah. Wait, did you answer the two things you brought up? The two reactions to it?
What were they? I don't remember.
It was, well, that what then do you hold on to, I guess, if it's not an axis of truth and untruth, I think. And then the other,
yeah,
ones.
Yeah.
Or what are you look? What are you then looking for?
Well, the questions were, what are you, what ought we, what should we, what are we justified in applying the truth non-truth binary to?
Yeah.
And
I guess like fact, absence, right? Or is that not sure? Like the mountain is higher than the sea. Like that has a truth, non-truth and present.
Well, the mountains are higher than the sea. I mean, yeah. Despite the fact that there are mountains under the sea.
Yeah. Right.
But that's, so we'll discount those. But yeah,
there's always,
I mean,
an exception.
I mean,
the moon is higher than the mountains.
So take the mountains as higher than this. The moon is higher than the mountains.
How's that?
Yeah, the moon is, well, higher.
Okay.
Space is not vertical and horizontal, I'd like to remind you. Okay, yeah, so keep trying to find something that we can ask as if it's true or not. I mean,
yeah, maybe there's.
This is where you start to get, things start to get really weird.
Yeah, right.
I mean, let's go back to the mountains are higher than the sea. And again, ignoring the mountains that are under the sea. Mountains on land are higher than the sea. Let's say that. or we could say something to the effect of all river sources are higher than the sea. Let's say something like that. But I think, I mean, in what way is that true? We can go out and measure, right? And
yeah,
we can do altitude assessments, and we can say it's higher than the sea. And so we've said it's true, and then we've gone out and we found something. We found that the thing we've said that thing about reflects that saying. Mm-hmm. That is, as I've pointed out, the adequational theory,
mm-hmm,
of truth.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've said is true because we found evidence for what we said outside of what we said, or what we taught, what we said it about, right? That the mountains are higher than the sea is not a truth. The truth lies in our proposition that mountains are higher than the sea. So the mountains are higher than the sea is true. Mountains being higher than the sea is not necessarily true. Truth is a truth is a thing we ascribe to propositions. That's Wittgensteinian, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. However, that truth is very temporary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Someday there will be no mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you turn the world upside down, and the world is upside down already,
mm-hmm.
the mountains are lower than the sea.
Mm-hmm.
There's no up and down.
So there's no way.
The sun rises every day. So far, the sun has risen every day. Might not rise tomorrow. So in what way are we talking about the sun? The sun rose every day before now, every day prior to now. How do we know? We weren't there. Were we there? No, we weren't there.
Right. So there's always like, I don't know, a twist of language that can take any proposition to not be true.
Probably, or be true. Yes, that's right.
Or twist of language or twist of,
that's right,
you know, existential paranoia or whatever you want to, or what's the phrase, existential anxiety or something.
Yeah.
Like you could always create something.
Yeah.
So then the point is that, yeah.
Well,
trying to find truth claims in that context is just, helpful.
I mean, yeah. I would say trying to find the truth of propositions whose truth is ascertained via external evidence,
mm-hmm.
can be done. You can seek that. You can do that. But I think you should understand that what you're actually going to achieve in the end is very circumscribed.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to ever attain, how should we say, a level of certainty,
mm-hmm.
that you probably are after.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes, or the issue becomes, what level of certainty are you after? And why are you after that level of certainty? And could that level of certainty be found somewhere else through a different relationship to truth that might provide you with what you're looking for?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think the clearing and concealing comes.
Mm-hmm.
Heidegger is saying, if the level of certainty you're looking for in truth were to be shunted over to the definition of truth as a clearing and concealing,
mm-hmm.
you might find that you're deeply satisfied,
mm-hmm.
by truth. But truth is how you define it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would define truth in a way in which the mountains are higher than the sea and the sun comes up every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they define truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. I think you can define truth however you want. But the important part is to make sure that what you're looking for in truth matches how you've defined truth.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually are trying to get something that can be gotten.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're not going to get it, because
mm-hmm.
it can't, yeah. be gotten.
Yeah.
So I think in your looking for the truth of, say, anxiety statements, or looking for an objective truth, or looking for truths that are certain, you're looking for something really heavy and really big and really profound and really, really reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if truth as understood through the first beginning,
yeah.
is going to provide that to you, because I think truth as understood through the first beginning is patently false.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. like, it is obviously false.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's literally like, here's the funny thing, right? We are enlightened beings now, right? Mm-hmm. It's 2025, 24, 23. It's 2020s,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Trump is president. We're obviously enlightened beings. So, you know, we see through the last 3,000, 4,000 years of civilization. We see through it like we're looking through air. Those people were God-deluded savages,
yeah.
right? We've seen through the religious mania,
yeah.
that this earth was subjected to. Yeah. And in many ways, it's subjected to in certain areas, but there's this new enlightenment. Well, but guess what?
Yeah.
God is dead. And you know what else is dead? Truth.
Yeah.
But we haven't done that yet.
Yeah, the truth. But the mountains are higher than the sea. No?
Well, God exists too.
Yeah.
If the mountains are higher than the sea is a truth,
yeah,
then God absolutely exists.
Yeah.
In the same way.
Right. Yeah. I think the maybe it's like you have to then apply it to everything. So if you're going to say
you do,
if you're going to say the mountains are higher than the sea and God exists, and this is an anxiety thought and it doesn't matter, you have to be able to actually apply it to everything. But if you can't apply it to anything, which I can't really with my anxiety, I can't just say, like, I go through all the, like, you know, mountains and sea being inverted, you know, like I could go through all of that with anxiety. So if I'm going to apply that to there, then I have to apply it to everything. And then I do get to the point where there's no real truth.
Well, there's no real truth as truth has been defined by the first beginning.
Yeah.
I would say when your son runs into the room.
Yeah.
And jumps up and down and dances and then leaves the room, you have just experienced truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you see the moon rising over the mountain.
Yeah.
When you see the mountain is higher than the sea, right? You're seeing truth.
Yeah.
So it's a phenomenal definition of truth.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to loop back to Trump, and we should, he's the president-elect now, I think one thing that's interesting about Trump is his, again, his claim of the fake news. Mm-hmm. And fake news is not interesting because there's some news that's fake and some news that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Fake news actually means, oh, right, all news is fake.
Yeah.
And all news is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah.
It's all fake.
Yeah.
And it's all true.
Uh-huh.
That's the point.
Yeah.
Because why is that the point, and why is that an important point? Because there's a huge portion of our population who believes that some news is true and some mm-hmm. news is fake.
Mm-hmm.
And they're ready to go to war for that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Fake news means all news is true and all news is fake. There's no need to have a war.
Mm-hmm.
And to put it crassly, it's just a show, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a show.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get too attached to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we'll have more discovery of what revealing and concealing is.
Awesome.
We've had a bit of a revealing concealing tonight.
I love that.
But now it's concealed.
I love that.
Then it's time to go to sleep.
Yep. It's a beautiful topic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.